Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com. On behalf of everybody at HeritageRadioNetwork.com, we'd like to send a special thank you to the Hearst Ranch, our biggest supporter and longest-running sponsor since we first started in 2009. Hearst Ranch is the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. Since 1865, the Hearst family has raised cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of the Central California coast. The result is beef with extraordinary flavor that's as memorable and natural as the surrounding landscape. For more information, visit www.hearstranch.com.
Hey, hey, you're listening to Let's Eat In on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Kathy Irway, and we're here at Roberta's again. It's a crisp fall day, Monday. And, you know, we've done a lot of talking about growing your own food or getting it direct from the farm, maybe join a CSA, something like that. But I don't think we've ever really talked too much about how the grocery store weighs into this whole scale of procuring your food for the table. So I'm very, very excited to have a guest who knows quite a lot about that. Sam McGannum is the second generation owner of Byrate Market and the founder of the Byrate family of businesses, which includes Byrate Creamery, 18 Reasons, and Byrate Farms. And he's on the phone here from San Francisco. Hi, Sam.
Hi, thanks for having me, Kathy.
Thank you so much for joining, and I'm sorry that it couldn't be in person in this lovely little shoebox we're sitting in.
I love your shoebox. It's awesome.
Okay, cool. How's everything in the West Coast? Is it sunny and delicious?
It was yesterday, and in classic San Francisco fashion, it's overcast, foggy, and misty as all hell. So it's the ride that we live every day.
Well, you guys also have a longer growing season, so I'm very jealous about that.
We do, yeah.
Well, so Sam, I know you're just coming out, launching, I believe, October 18th with this beautiful cookbook, which I'm holding. It's called The Byrate Market's Eat Good Food, A Grocer's Guide to Shopping, Cooking, and Creating Community Through Food. Very intriguing, and just so you know, anyone listening in New York, which I think most of you guys are, this San Francisco-based supermarket and cookbook is having a launch party at Brooklyn Kitchen on October 28th, and it's quite an interesting event. It's called Stocking Up, How the Grocer and Shopper Can Take Back Food Choice Event. And what do you think is going to happen at that event? Do you know, Sam?
I do. You know, what I'm hoping is going to happen is that there's going to be a stimulating conversation about the path that food takes to get from the actual farm to the table. And most of the food that gets onto our tables in this country really has to transfer through the grocery store. And you know, my feeling is that not enough grocery stores take that responsibility seriously enough. You know, they end up selling food that multinational corporations want them to sell. And I feel that they need to curate the selection a little bit more, really think about the people that they're feeding and be a little bit more selective about the food that they actually sell.
Interesting. So you think that there's a lot of pressure to sell what's not only maybe cheapest, but what is being kind of force-fed to supermarkets to buy?
I think there's a ton of pressure. I mean, if you think about all the advertising dollars that, you know, companies like Kraft and General Mills spend, they need partners, and their partners are the supermarket, and that's the outlet. And so they're all in business together, and I think they're working together to keep the price of commodities cheap, to keep labor cheap, so that food is as cheap as it possibly can, so they can just sell a lot of it.
Mm-hmm. And now, so I love this little, an old ad that I see in the book, but it says they had it straight in 1914, and it's a kind of a, I don't know what it is, but it says food. Buy it with thought, cook it with care, use less wheat and meat, buy local foods, serve just enough, use what is left, don't waste it. So was that like an old piece of, what is that word I'm looking for?
It's war propaganda.
Propaganda.
It was from 1914, and it was developed by the U.S. Food Administration as a means of rallying a lot of patriotism around the war. And one of the things that was needed was food and supplies for the military. And so they needed Americans to make sacrifices. And those sacrifices, ironically, are the same message that we need to be instilling in everybody today. You know, we waste too much food. We eat too much. We're not thinking about it enough. We're not cooking enough.
Mm-hmm.
And 100 years later, and that message is still really clear. But the government really isn't doing anything to support that message.
So you kind of resurrected that. You just came across it, and now it's one of the nice little decorations in the shop at Buy-Rite.
You know, we actually a good friend, an ex-employee of ours, when he left as a thank you, actually got me an original print of that poster, and it inspired me so much that we've actually put it onto a canvas bag that our shoppers use when they're shopping around the store.
Cool. I had the pleasure of checking out your of Buy-Rite and both both Buy-Rite and the Creamery, which is so delicious. I'm sure anyone who travels and reads the guides of where to eat would see Buy-Rite Creamery as one of the stops. But it's definitely a different type of grocery store experience, Buy-Rite Market. And that has only evolved in the past, since you took the reins in 1997, I believe?
Yeah, 97, we took the space over. We, after about 9 months of renovation, we opened in June of 98. So we're on our 14th year.
Wow. And incredibly, from the introduction, it sounds kind of like almost you were, it was like thrust upon you. Your father and your uncle owned this grocery store since the 60s. And they asked you to take up the reins, and you were like, no, you're kicking and screaming at first. Is that right?
It's exactly right. You know, I spent my entire childhood working here. I started working here in 74 when I was six. You know, my mom would give me a nickel and put me on the streetcar with a bag of food to take to my dad after school. And, you know, I grew up doing a lot of my homework in the store, and I learned...
And eating every meal in the store.
Oh, yeah, totally. You know, and some of them, many of them were not good. But, you know, I grew up in the business. And, you know, like lots of kids who grew up in family businesses, you know, they want nothing to do with them when they're of age to make a decision on their own. And so when I graduated from high school, I decided I wanted to be a cook. I wanted to get into the restaurant business and went to cooking school at City College in San Francisco, and ended up moving to Switzerland to cook for a year, and I fell in love with food. I fell in love with how valuable it is,
wow,
how intimate it is to feed people.
Well, you didn't stray too far, I guess, if you had a passion for food, and it's not like you ran off to, I don't know, what's the opposite of groceries? I don't know. It's sort of related, I guess.
I thought I wanted to be an accountant or a lawyer. You know? And I probably would have had a bullet in my head if I did that. I can't imagine waking up every day and putting a suit on.
So, okay, so you're forced into the profession. Not really, but you had a family obligation, a feeling of obligation.
Oh, yeah, and I wouldn't say that. You know, it wasn't really forced. Mm-hmm. You know, I had a restaurant at the time when the opportunity came. You know, I had my own restaurant in the financial district for about 7 years, and we were in a lease that was coming to an end with no real clear hope of renewing, and it was thinking about what the next step, you know, for my brother and I would be. And, you know, my dad called me up one day and said, hey, you know, the guy who's renting the space wants out. You guys want in? And after, you know, a few weeks of arguments and discussions, you know, my brother and I decided to do it. You know, and we wanted to do a really cool store. And the most important thing to me was that I still needed to be able to cook. Mm-hmm. And so we built a kitchen inside the space, right, you know, right in the middle of it, so you could actually hear and smell all the food being prepared. We wanted our guests to be part of that action, to experience the food and to really trust that you know, they could see everything that we were doing. That transparency really built to a lot of long-lasting relationships that have built the business over the last number of years.
Well, it's a really interesting, inspiring story because just knowing the grocery as it is today, it just is such a work of hard labor of love, it seems, and so detailed. I really think that there ought to be a James Beard Award for grocery stores now that I think about it. I mean, and this, because it's so much part of bringing food to the table, and just like a restaurant or a chef, and, you know. Maybe, we'll see, but you do have a book, so that's pretty exciting.
It is exciting. You know, I mean, ultimately what restaurants do, it's the same thing that we do. You know, we
mm-hmm.
feed people.
Yep.
And it was that experience as a chef that I realized how critical that role is. And I mean, whether I'm putting a can of food on a shelf, or whether I'm making this beautiful plate and putting it on a table with white linen, it's the same. And I feel that anybody who's in the business of selling food really is in the business of feeding, and that needs to be taken more seriously.
You're also in the business of educating people, because it sounds like through the way you sell food, you aim to broaden not just the palate, but just consumers' awareness of where it's coming from. There's so many detailed notes about the origins throughout the store and now throughout the book.
Right.
And I know that's something that's done at 18 Reasons, which is a community kind of workshop space down the street.
Yep.
And, you know, why do you think that's something, you know, obviously that's not part of the business, or is it? I mean, why is that so important, you think?
Education?
Yeah.
And 18 Reasons? I mean,
yeah,
giving
all these really detailed cues to consumers about what each coffee, you know, came from and so forth.
People are dying to know where their food's coming from. And I think people are finally standing up and shouting instead of just talking about understanding that, that transparency and how food is getting to them. And, you know, there's so much confusion around food, and there's so many, different and contradictory viewpoints around what's right and what's wrong. You know, and our role ultimately has been, since the day we started, is to first and foremost wow people with how good food tastes.
Mm-hmm.
And once you put that an amazing strawberry in somebody's mouth and their eyes light up, it's easy then to talk to them about why organic grown strawberries are so critical. It's easy to talk to them about the dangers of methyl iodide and the impact of the land, the impact that those chemicals have on the land and on the workers that work the fields. Mm-hmm. And so, our
it kind of breaks the ice a little, right? Yeah. Makes it fun. It kind of breaks the ice a little, like makes it fun. Now here's the the bad part.
Right. Right. And that's like one of the coolest advantages that we have is you know, we're able to share food with people all day long. And we've got samples going on. People can taste whatever they want. I mean, you know, it's not like we're going to be able to cook off a steak and let them taste it, but sometimes we do. and that's an important part of building that trust. That if you can actually taste that food before you buy it and hear the story behind it and know that there was a human involved in producing that food as opposed to a factory farm, an industrial system, then you're gonna feel good about supporting that. You're gonna feel good knowing that you're supporting your own local community, that you're supporting the local economy, that you're supporting somebody that you can actually pick up the phone and call.
Yeah,
and that's powerful.
That's pretty neat. Do you find that people are cooking more than ever, or less than ever, or do you get a sense of that from the amount of folks you've gotten to know through the store and your, I don't know, community of shoppers?
Yeah, you know, we're a store for cooks, and that's one of the things that I love. You know, we're an ingredient-driven store. We don't have very many, like, overly processed packaged kind of foods, though we do produce a lot of our own meals that are made in our house,
mm-hmm.
utilizing the same ingredients that
we
sell.
Oh, yeah, the salads and stuff, yeah.
Exactly. But what what I'm seeing is that yes, people are cooking more. I mean, food is, you know, is becoming part of, you know, people's everyday lives. But I wish, you know, I hope that people will cook even more. You know, I'd love to see more people spend more time around the table, around their kitchens, teaching their kids how to cook. You know, sharing that time as a family together as something to celebrate, as opposed to it being a chore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not being in front of the computer, not being in front of the TV, but just actually being with each other, spending that time with each other.
I hope so too, and thank you, because I think that, you know, as someone who's advocates for cooking more, I think that your store and just the whole, you know, community that you've built through it makes shopping and cooking food a lot more sexy and fun and trendy, like going to your restaurant perhaps is.
Yeah.
So thank you for doing that.
To me, that's like exactly what we live for.
Yeah. Any Buy Right Brooklyn coming in the future?
book line?
No, Brooklyn.
Oh, Buy Right Brooklyn. You know,
here.
You know, everyone wants a Buy Right in their town, in their neighborhood, and you know, before we opened Buy Right, we were in a food desert as well, and I think that, you know, hopefully through the book and through just, you know, getting word out, more and more people will be inspired to do, you know, bring that little sexy, you know, conscientious effort to retail and to grocery stores. You know, you see them. There's some great stores in Brooklyn. You guys are lucky.
Yes, we are. And not to diss Brooklyn, but I hope so. We'll see. Maybe your book will help in spreading that inspirational model. We're going to cut to a really quick musical clip that you chose. And what is it again?
It's Month of Sundays from Middle Mackey.
All right, we'll be right back. All right, we're back with Let's Eat In. I'm Kathy Irway, your host. That was a song chosen by my guest today, who is Sam McGannum, who is not joined in geographical terms, but through the phone in San Francisco. Hi there.
Hey.
Hey. So Sam, again, is the owner of Buy Right Market, Buy Right Creamery, 18 Raisins, and Buy Right Farms. Tell me a little bit about what Buy Right Farms and how that came about. Like, what exactly is it?
Well, we're currently about an acre and a half that we're farming. We're going to go up to 2 acres next spring. It's in Sonoma, about an hour door-to-door from the store. And it's been one of the coolest things that we've done. We started the farm on half an acre about 4 years ago. And it was a collaboration with Simon Richard, who's our produce buyer. He's been our produce buyer for the last 8 years. But before he moved out to San Francisco and started working with us, he was a farmer in Colorado.
Hmm.
And he was dying to get back to the soil, to get his hands dirty again. And, you know, over a series of conversations, we committed to doing this. And
wow.
It's been the funnest thing. You know, staff get to go up there and harvest, they get to plant, they get to weed, they get to see exactly where their food's coming from and how hard that work is, and their sense of appreciation for what organic farmers do has risen tremendously.
And, you know, talk about different restaurants doing this whole farm to get table you know, this is what you sell in your store. This is direct from your farm, an hour away. Very cool model. I hope to see more of that happening too. So that is, does that supply, I mean, how much percentage of the store's produce would you say?
You know, it's not a huge amount. Most of it actually goes to our kitchen.
Okay.
We utilize it for a lot of the prepared foods. And so during those summer and fall months, a good chunk of our seasonal menu, the food that we actually have available for guests to pick up, comes from ingredients from veggies that we've grown on the farm.
Well, that is so fun. Has farming been a new adventure for yourself?
It's probably been one of the best things that's happened in my life. You know, as a family now, I've got two daughters, and my wife. We go up there almost every weekend and just get to be away from the city and actually get time with each other. We get to put our hands in the dirt and pick carrots and then go and cook them together, and it's been great for them.
That's,
you know, just seeing how their eyes light up and
very cool.
Perfect. Yeah.
So I'm flipping through this book right now, by the way, and everything is making me really, really hungry. It's just so, all of them are just kind of practical, like, you know, not too crazy, but just mouthwatering. So I always ask this to every guest, and I think that you'd be a good expert on this. But what would you say would be the ultimate date meal that you could ever brainstorm and pull off?
You know, it's so funny. I just had my ultimate date meal a couple nights ago. My wife and I just celebrated our 10-year anniversary.
And oh, congrats!
Thanks. Yeah, we cooked at home together, and we started with a frisée salad with crispy bacon, a poached egg, crunchy croutons, and a sherry vinaigrette with lots of mustard, and it was out of this world. You know, just break that egg and let the yolk kind of mix in. It was the perfect, you know, first course. And then we had local albacore, which, you know, Pacific albacore is, you know, such a wonderful fish, cooked rare and served on a simple salad of dry farm potatoes and dry farm tomatoes.
So you kind of
caper
seared
anchovy vinaigrette.
Okay.
It was really clean. And my favorite dessert of all time, you know, and only can happen this time of year, is a fig raspberry galette.
Oh, fig raspberry galette. Yeah, because fig, well, we don't even have figs to begin with, but
I assume like one of the biggest bummers in the East Coast. Oh, it totally is. I know I have so many friends who are dying to figure out how to get great figs shipped over there.
So figs and raspberries, that sounds like a great combination.
It is. The raspberries just give it that nice amount of acidity that brighten the whole thing up. It's perfect.
Wow, yum. You know what? I found a similar recipe in this book to your date meal's main course, the seared saffron albacore tuna with fennel olive tapenade.
It's very, very similar. You know, and I'm kind of one of those cooks that never cooks from a recipe. Mm-hmm. And so it was really strange for me developing recipes for a book. And I've never repeated, you know, there's only one recipe that I've actually ever repeated and never really exactly the same, but there's a recipe in the book for spaghetti with tuna, capers, garlic, and chili flakes.
Okay.
It's kind of a little riff on linguine with clams, but it's a dish that you can make just from ingredients that you have in your pantry. It's, you know, canned tuna, good spaghetti, olive oil, a little white wine, chili flakes, garlic, and a little parsley if you've got it, but you don't need it.
That would be the
perfect
date meal on the fly from the cupboard.
That's my meal on the fly. Yeah.
Yes. That sounds like a really good one, and I like the idea of having, you know, the pantry that's already equipped to serve your guests at any time, which is always fun.
Yeah, I mean that actually lessens the chore factor with cooking. You know, if you've got some good basic ingredients available, then it's really easy. All you've got to do is just go to the market, pick up a few things that look inspiring, and then put them together.
I like how your cookbook is arranged from seasons. So there's spring, summer, fall, and winter. I see that happening more and more, and it makes sense. And thanks. You mentioned it was difficult to transcribe into recipes, and you know, I'm sure that's always a challenge. But there's so many, and they all look so great. Do you have any other favorites you'd like to kind of put out there?
God, you know, there's the recipe for the sumac roasted chicken is another one that I love. It was a dish that was inspired by my mother. You know, and she learned it from her mother, and it was a dish I served on the menu at my restaurant for a number of years. It's just a really good, flavorful roasted chicken that you could cook any time of year, mm-hmm. whether no matter what season it is.
Using the dried sumac as the kind of rub?
Yeah, exactly. The dried sumac just adds this really nice tangy flavor to the bird, and it brightens the whole dish up.
And that's an ingredient that we see a bit in Middle Eastern or Israeli. I know it's in, what's it called, za'atar spice mixes?
Yeah. Some za'atar mixes have sumac in them, but traditional za'atar doesn't have sumac in it.
Okay.
It's just thyme and sesame seeds.
It's so fun how something like that can spice up something so ordinary sounding as roast chicken. But that makes me really want to cook a roast chicken right now. Thank you for the inspiration. All right. So we'll look forward to having you in town on the 18th the 28th at the Brooklyn Kitchen for that conversation. And I'm sure you'll be doing more events in San Fran and thereabouts for the book's release, probably.
Yeah. There's a lot going on. You know, I'll be back in New York in November, and then up in Portland and Seattle in December. So
yeah, should be
excited.
An exciting month. All right. Well, thank you so much again for joining us, Sam. And to everyone, check out buyrightmarket.com. Is that correct?
Buyrightmarket.com. Yeah.
All right.
Thanks.
We'll see you next week.
All right.
Bye.
Bye.
Today we'd like to send a special thank you to the following restaurants for supporting No Goat Left Behind, Ottomanelli & Sons, and Salamuria Rossi. Show your support at these restaurants by ordering one of the menu items featuring goat. Goat is the most eaten protein in the entire world, yet in the US we import most of our goat. Our dairy farms are forced to kill some male goats at birth because there's no market for them. Help make a change. Support No Goat Left Behind. As a part of National Food Day, St. John's Bread and Life, Brooklyn's innovative and life-saving food service program based in Bedford-Stuyvesant, is inviting Brooklyn chefs and purveyors to learn about how the organization is marrying the procurement of old-fashioned, locally grown organic produce with the latest technology to deliver healthy, cost-effective meals to those in need. St. John's Bread and Life, located at 795 Lexington Avenue, will hold an open house on Monday, October 24th from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. Visit www.foodday.org to sign up for the event.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.